cost it tens of thousands of dollars. Debt on education, which is itself is a human right.
They have soared.
They have soared.
They have soared.
Privacy as a commodity.
They have spent millions of dollars on legal teams that look for ways to get them out of contracts in regards to health insurance.
They continue to buy generic forms of medicine that could save people's lives or provide relief in order to protect investments.
Consistently outsource labor and use that outsourcing as leverage to cut workers' health care and pay.
They have influenced the courts to achieve the same rights as people. None of the culpability or responsibility.
They have sold.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. We start the program with Jimmy Carter at the Civil Rights Summit. President Jimmy Carter gave the closing address on the first day of a three-day Civil Rights Summit hosted by the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. The occasion was the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's signing of the Civil Rights Act. And then after that, James Loney on captivity in Iraq. James is the Canadian peace activist who was held hostage for 118 days in Iraq. Before that, James worked for several years for the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq and Palestine.
Well, apparently I don't have to say welcome because they just did.
Thank you, they did.
You are most welcome here. We are honored to have you here, Mr. President. You're very kind to do this, knowing that you were just here a couple of years ago. So thank you so much for being here.
I'd like to come back whenever you invite me. Thank you.
Well, don't say that, because we're going to invite you again. You know that. Mr. President, David just, in your introduction, talked about the fact that you were a product of the segregated South, and yet you grew up free of sort of racism that seems to be endemic to so many of your generation from the Deep South. Why did you grow up free of racial prejudice?
Well, I grew up during the Great Depression and also during the time for illegal segregation. The Supreme Court, Congress, the churches, the American Bar Association all said separate but equal was the law of the land. It was separate but it wasn't equal. I grew up in a little village, unincorporated, named Archery, Georgia, just 2 miles west of Plains, and we were the only white family who lived there. My father was a farmer, and we were surrounded by 55 other families who were African-American. And all of my playmates, all of my companions in the field, the ones that I hunted with and fished with, wrestled with, fought with, loved, were black people. And so my life was really shaped, perhaps as much as any other white American who ever lived, by a black culture. My daddy was a full-time worker away from home. My mother was a registered nurse, and she was on duty 20 hours a day. She got off duty at night at 10 o'clock, and she came home and washed her uniforms and took a shower and left me and my two sisters instructions for the next day. Then she went back on duty at 2 o'clock in the morning, so she spent 20 hours. So I was home a lot by myself with African-American women who my father hired to take care of us children. So I learned to appreciate a black culture. And when I wrote a book called Hour Before Daylight, at the end of the book, I tried to think of the five people other than my parents who shaped my life. Only two of those five were white. One was my high school teacher, and another was my daddy's brother. The other three were African-American. So I left home having been influenced by my mother, who, being a registered nurse, spent her time in the homes of black people nursing them when they couldn't go to the hospital because they couldn't afford it. And mother never paid any attention to racial segregation. She could get away with it because she was a member of a medical profession. And so when I went off to the Navy, I was in battleships twice, and then I was in a series of submarines. And it was during the time I was in the Navy that Harry Truman ordained in 1948 that all the military forces would be free of racial segregation. And this was one of the most courageous political acts that I knew about in my life, because it was a very unpopular thing for him to do. But it changed my life on a submarine. And I saw at practical firsthand that white and black people should live, and it was better for both of us to live as equals. So when I came home from the Navy in 1953, it was just the beginning of the civil rights stirrings, you might say. And so I was then immersed in a segregated society, being more moderate or liberal than my neighbors were. And we had boycotts against my business, and I remember one time I drove up in front of the only service station in Plains, and they refused to put gasoline in my car because they considered us to be, I won't use the word, lovers of black people. And so we struggled through that, and we lived in that government housing project. We didn't have any money. And so it was out of that environment that I saw, when I went into the state senate, how far we still had to go. That was in 1962. And then in 2 years later, when I was finishing up my first year in the Senate, Lyndon Johnson came along with his great insight and political courage and wisdom and tenacity, and literally changed my personal life and the life of everyone that lived in America. So that's kind of a not too rapid rundown of how I got started by appreciating Lyndon Johnson. I never had a chance to meet him. I was just a peanut farmer when he was running for office, but I was overwhelmed with what he had done, and that's when I wrote this letter. I was governor of Georgia when I wrote the letter after he left office, and I was on the way to a sheriff's convention, but what he had done preyed on my mind, so I wrote him a handwritten letter and sent it to him. I'm very proud that you found it. Okay.
We are too. David recited a quote from your inaugural speeches as yes. Georgia governor, where you said that it's time to put segregation behind us. What kind of resistance did you meet from those intractable segregationists when you handed down non-segregationist policies?
Well, you know, just get the time schedule in effect. 1964 was a Voting Rights Act, and I was elected governor in 1970, and I made my inaugural speech in 1971. And as I traveled around the state, I saw that the ravages of racial segregation were not very greatly attenuated, except in the law. And so when I was elected governor, I had just an 8-minute speech, very short speech, and the main thing I said was, I've traveled the state of Georgia more than anybody that ever campaigned. I didn't have any money. I shook hands, my wife and I shook hands with 600,000 people in factory shift lines. I said, and I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over, and it's quoted there. And it was so, I use this expression, reluctant, earth-shaking in Georgia and in the South, that in 2 weeks I was on the front cover of Time magazine. And it's hard to know that 7 years after the Voting Rights, the Civil Rights Act was passed, Equal Rights Amendment was passed, that was, it's still a kind of a startling thing to say. So Georgia, though, in my opinion, was ready to change. And there was never an inclination in Georgia to stand in the schoolhouse door or to violate the rulings of the law after Lyndon Johnson did his wonderful service there. So Georgia always complied with the law. And I think that's one reason that Atlanta, which was then stirring, got ahead of Birmingham and some other cities, because we didn't have police dogs and fire hoses against black people. We had a very enlightened state.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Once I built a mortgage, made it run, made it race against prime. Once I built a mortgage, now it's done. Brother, can you spell subprime? Once in sharkskin suits, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodly don't. A half a million fools went into debt hell. I was the cat with the loan. Say, don't you remember they called me Alan, Hank, Larry, and Tim? Say, don't you remember I'm your pal? Brother, can you spare a diamond? When citizens default, I triple lock my vault. But some of my homies are too big to fail. Supersize their bonus, on the poor I'll put the onus. Anything to keep my broker's ass out of that jail. Unprecedented failure of our national securities. We must discover who could be to blame. Could be Obama, Osama, or your mama. Heads we win, tails you lose. Main Street's cool, but Wall Street rules. Won't you purchase our paper? Please do, I insist. If you don't like it, buddy, well, default swap this. Paulson fit the battle at Goldman Sachs, and Wall Street's tumbling down. If there's no remaining capital, what happens to our ism? I never thought I'd ever see the day when government has a role to play. But it's true, we're all set. We can wash away the debt and profit if not learn from our collapse. I love shooting craps. Housing bubbles, don't you whine. Makes me happy like a landmine. Lehman was lynched merrily in the oh-so-stern bear market. Bail out the banks and offer thanks. Don't gross. The economy's just lost one half of its worth, and you've only lost your house. Profits all gone. It was the era of the get. Now it's time for socialism of the debt. As for the paradox of deleveraging, which leads to alcoholic beveraging, the way to explain it to you nice, is that the selling of trash drives down prices. We need a clean plan, not just a mean plan. Why penalize the poor rich people who have lost more than you mortgage moochers ever could have? It's not like the sky is falling, though it's true your roof is gone. All is not lost. But as it says in the sonnet, doggone it, we're working on it. There's no shortage of reportage on our mortgage meltdown, so why not keep the next phase of the bailout on the down low? You'd never miss a million, and you cannot spell quazillion, so why not leave it up to those who caused it, those who lost it, those who reverse Santa Claused it, who believe in the American dream. Especially the part about the Ponzi scheme. A nation of whiners gets no golden parachute. When we're through, you will be lucky if you've got a birthday suit. So what if we were all in a hypnotic trance, from which we awoke with the collapse of the tallest towers of finance? Well, Rome wasn't built in a day. I know I drove this country into a train wreck, but I feel a sudden need for a blank check. So please, won't you buy my... What's that Yiddish word I'm looking for? Drek, not Shrek! Have no fear, we won't let it happen again. this year.
And now back to Jimmy Carter at the Civil Rights Summit.
It's been 50 years since Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. Have we progressed on race as much as you would have hoped?
No.
Where have we fallen short?
Well, we're falling short in a lot of ways. We still have gross disparity between black and white people on employment, the quality of education. A good many of the public schools in the South are still segregated. As a result of what President Johnson did, a lot of so-called segregation academies were founded, so white people could send their kids to a still segregated school. And they still are very powerful and strong throughout the South. And the recent decisions by the U.S. Congress, which are lamentable in some ways, indicate a very strong preference for the robbing, you might say, the public school system of its vitality and its funding and that sort of thing, and giving favors to people that go to private schools and so forth like that. So that perpetuates disparity in education. And obviously in employment, I've already mentioned the unemployment rolls are much higher for blacks. In some areas, young black people have an unemployment rate of 25 to 50% in some communities. So there's not any real equality between the two that exist in this country. And we are pretty much dormant now. We kind of accept self-congratulations about the wonderful 50th anniversary, which is wonderful. But we feel like, Lyndon Johnson did it. We don't have to do anything anymore. So I think too many people are at ase with the still existing disparity.
It was 40 years ago tonight that Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record in Atlanta.
That's right.
While you were governor.
I was there. I was sitting on the front row. Yeah, I know.
Talk about that moment.
Oh, well. As far as I'm an avid baseball fan. I mentioned my parents. When I was growing up, my mother and daddy didn't go on vacations. They were very busy. But when lay-by time came on the farm, when we couldn't cultivate the crops anymore and it wasn't time for harvest, my mother and daddy took their only vacation, and they went for 2 weeks. Every year they went to a different city that had a Major League Baseball team. And so they would go to Minneapolis, and then they go to St. Paul, and then they would go to Detroit, and then they go to Chicago, then to Boston, and then to New York, and so forth. And they would spend the full 2 weeks at baseball games. So I was inherited the gene of loving baseball. And then when the Atlanta Braves came to Atlanta, I was lucky enough to get prepared to run for governor, and I was governor of Georgia the night that Hank Aaron hit his home run. We knew he might hit it that night, and I had a front row seat. Ted Turner owned the Braves, as you know, then. And so when Hank Aaron hit his home run, I had already prepared a license plate, a Georgia license plate, HR715. And the Chamber of Commerce of Atlanta had taken up a collection to buy him a new Cadillac, which I think cost at that time about $10,000. And my tag cost $10. So we had a ceremony on the field, and they gave him the Cadillac. I gave him a tag for it. And mine and Hank's photograph was in Encyclopedia Britannica with me handing him the tag. So I got ahead of everybody else, and Hank's is still a friend of mine. By the way, if I weren't here, I would be in Atlanta with Hank Aaron tonight.
Thank you. We love Hank Aaron. We're very glad you're here.
And he knows why I'm here. Thank you.
You are a born-again Christian. You teach Sunday school regularly. There are a lot of people of faith who don't support gay marriage because of their religiosity.
Yes, I know.
What is your view on gay marriage? What would you tell those folks?
Well, I belong to Maranatha Baptist Church, and that's where I teach Sunday school every Sunday. Last Sunday and this next Sunday as well, about 35 times a year. Plains, Georgia has about 630 people in it, and about 60% are African Americans. So we have roughly 200 white people who live in Plains. And I know there are six people that are openly gay in Plains. They come to our church, and they are welcome. We never even think about the fact that they may be different from the rest of us. They are welcomed. And so I believe that I believe in what St. Paul wrote to the Galatians. He said there's no difference between people in the eyes of God. There's no difference between men and women. There's no difference between Jews and Gentiles. There's no difference between servants and masters, and I don't believe there's a difference between people because of their sexual orientation. And I hope that they... My own belief is that the civil services should be approved all over the country. It's up to individual states, and more are doing it every year. I think it soon will be all over the country. As far as an individual church is concerned, I'm a Baptist, and I believe that each congregation is, you might say, autonomous. We relate directly to God. We don't have bishops and so forth to tell us. The congregation of our church, whether a child 8 years old or somebody like me, almost 90 years old, is a member, we have one vote, and that's what prevails. So I think that each individual church ought to have a right to say that we will accept the marriage of this or that. By the way, our church wouldn't have any problem with it, but I think other churches, I wouldn't try to mandate by law that other churches would have to go against their own beliefs.
Your new book, Call to Action, which is available in our bookstore, signed by the president as well, is about the plight of women in America and the world today. Talk a little bit about this book, if you would, and what led you to write it.
Well, Harry mentioned, I think, that the Carter Center was started after I left the White House. We have programs in about 80 countries in the world, health programs, education programs, agriculture programs. We monitor elections. We've just finished our 97th troubled election. We negotiate peace. So we have programs all over the world. And we've gotten to know for the last 32 years the life of people in a fairly intimate way in the most remote jungle and desert areas of Africa and Latin America and poor countries around the world. That's where we concentrate. And we've seen during those 30-some years an almost unbelievable prejudice and persecution of women and girls. The most horrible statistic that I know is the fact that we believe about 40 million people were killed in the Second World War, the most violent war in history, 40 million. Four times as many little baby girls have been killed in this generation by their own parents, who strangled the little girls at birth. And because they are poverty-stricken, they can't afford to pay a large family, they don't know much about birth control, and so they want a boy, and boys. And then we know that in China and India and other countries, the government mandates a limit on family size. One is best, two is most. And so when a baby girl is born, they strangle her.
Ancestors lived with this earth. The land is the people, and the people are the land, and this is the land of our birth. But now you want to move us off this mesa, as if you can take a body from a soul. You want to take from us our paradise on earth and trade it for a mountain of coal. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? Liver of our mother, and it must remain in the ground. The trees are her lungs, and the rivers are her blood, and they should all be left as they were found. But now you slurry coal across these pastures, and your trees all go to feed your hungry mill. You would have us live in rows of shacks without our sheep on your church rock uranium spill. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? are spreading ever westward. They're coming to knock down a Hogan's door. We will say to anyone who'll listen, relocation nevermore. So won't you come to Big Mountain? Bring everything you can, but come today. This is the land where we belong, and this is the land where we will stay. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? What would you do if they were coming for you? What would you do if they were coming for you?
Now for something completely different.